Hello and welcome to In the Know. I'm Amol Sarva. Welcome back.
This series celebrates 30 years of New York tech, and I'm talking to many of the key people. This time I've got Ben Lehrer, founder of Thrillist and the co-founder of Lehrer Hippo Ventures, one of the key firms here in town.
That there is this 30 years of New York tech thing happening.
I'm one of the co-hosts. I'm well aware.
January. Sir.
January
26th.
Okay.
Is when it is.
Good. Yeah. I'm excited.
Keep your calendar clear.
It is clear.
If possible.
It's already in. I'm ready to rip. It's Friday night. I like that it's a Friday night.
Oh, it's
party.
A Friday night.
Yeah.
It's Jan 30.
Friday night. Yeah.
Is it Jan 30th? I thought it was 26th.
No, it's a Friday night, even which is better. So fun and weird. Like, I love the idea of getting all these people out on a Friday night. And
yeah, it's kind of a tricky evening for a business event.
Designed
that way.
I don't know that it's, like, really a business event. I think
party.
It's like a party. I think it's going to be over 1,000 people.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where is this thing?
Where?
It's at WSA.
It's at WSA. Whatever Emily is telling me.
It's WTF.
Is that the place downtown?
It's by Seaport.
It's by the Seaport. I thought
yeah.
so.
It's like a banquety venue kind of thing.
It's cooler than that.
This was the one that Kevin Ryan was like.
Kevin likes it, but like Air, one of our portfolio companies, you recently hosted like a culty summit there.
Interesting.
Sorry.
Whatever.
He doesn't know.
What are you drinking there, little?
Oh, I got some stuff from your fridge.
Little Celsius.
Yeah, I'm a very big fan of all taurine related drinks. And that is a longer conversation. They kind of get a bad rap.
What about the ingredient in the drink update? It's another caffeine side, you know, one of these caffeine spinoffs. I can't remember what.
I don't think I've ever heard of Update.
Update is an energy drink that my understanding is it's doing quite well, and it's using its sort of key ingredient is this. Is a different caffeine alternative that is.
So this is one of your hot new deals.
No,
you
not one of my
about?
Deals. Not one of my deals. Just a company that I met years ago, but that I've heard is doing well recently.
Well, the consumer like products category, you're always surprised something gets huge, but the 999 other things don't. Okay, so Ben,
yes,
you know
sir.
What we are here to talk about.
Indeed.
So let's try and do that. And I guess you actually know a lot about it. So you're one of the co-hosts. You're organizing this thing. It's coming up very soon. It's January 30th at WSA. People can just show up. I guess they don't even need tickets now that they're going to listen to this thing. Not really.
Security. Is that true?
I assume there'll be security to block because people are going to hear about it. People are going to be checking in on Foursquare. But what is the occasion of this 30-year thing, because that's actually what this series is about, and you know, I've had a bunch of other folks on here and whatever, but you could probably give a nice preamble, like why are people doing
it? And it's funny because I have not been a part of New York tech for 30 years, but I have for about 20 years, which is terrifying and makes me feel a little bit old, but
yeah, I mean, at some point there'll be 30 years of next gen New York tech.
It seems that way, but I guess 30 years is sort of when like the first generation of tech startups emerged in New York and the first venture funds sort of set up shop here. And, you know, I think obviously there was a culture that existed in Boston to some degree and obviously very much so on the West Coast.
Well, Boston was a lot bigger and now it's smaller.
Yep.
So, I mean, that's a big change. And I mean, yes, the occasion is 1995. Like, what happened in 1995? Let me remind you. Here we go. You ready?
Yeah, I'm very ready.
Windows 95.
Okay, well, that tracks.
Sun released Java.
Okay.
Bezos started Amazon. Yahoo went from like school project to incorporated website company. Netscape IPO doubles on the first day. Dot-com frenzy. Pierre Omidyar starts like the thing that was eBay, but it was called AuctionWeb. Search engines, Alta Vista launches. 1996, actually, Google is incorporated. Pixar releases Toy Story, CGI movie. And the DVD was launched.
The DVD wasn't launched until 1995? Wow. That's crazy. That the DVD did not have a very long run, it turns out.
considering the size of the collection,
yeah, that's crazy. I have a lot more DVDs than years of DVDs. Yeah, I mean, and look, I didn't get to New York. I didn't come. I grew up in New York, but I graduated college in 2003, and so came back, you know, late 2003.
So you left New York for college
mm-hmm. in Philadelphia, and came back here, and basically, I guess it took me like a year and a half to sort of get the tech startup bug. I first worked for a guy named Andre Balazs, who owned a bunch of
the hotel guy.
Yeah, the hotel guy.
Yeah, legendary fun place
super
to be.
Fun. Yeah, the company was. It was actually a very small corporate office. I worked
like the Royalton, I think, was one of the famous Balazs.
It wasn't the Royalton. The Royalton was a Ian Schrager.
Ah.
But he had in New York, he had the Mercer. That was his like sort of like, you know, his flagship property here. And then he has out at Shelter Island, Sunset Beach.
Mm.
Those are like, and then his like other, he started the Standard.
Mm.
Had the Chateau Marmont in L.A. Just like sort of all very cool.
Legend, yeah.
Legend. Andre's total legend. And I worked in the corporate office with, you know, 25 or 30 other people, like very small. And I think like a lot of kids coming out of college really didn't know what I wanted to do. But, but you know, liked the nightlife and liked hospitality and liked eating. And
yeah, you know, and it's kind of a real estate job, I guess. Maybe you were working on... finding sites.
I was not on the development side. I was really mm-hmm. on the operation side.
Mm.
And so more like on property stuff. I grew up in New York and I liked the sort of cultural part of it. And so less, honestly, like didn't really, I think I didn't appreciate how little of the math how little I understood about
it. Oh, like, does it work? Is this
like,
actually
this
a good business?
How do you make money in this business?
It seems really fun. Everyone is, like, calling you to get in, but then will it actually
work?
Which, actually, I mean, the subtweet on some of the comments you made is, like, a bunch of really famous properties, but maybe not. Like, a huge empire has resulted, you know, some of the brands.
Some were good businesses. Some were less good businesses. You know, mm-hmm. we ended up selling the Standard, and the Standard then turned into a much bigger business under its next owner.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Andre knew how to create culture, and it was a really fun job. But while I was there, living in Manhattan, I sort of thought of the idea for Thrillist.
Right. I mean, that's where we're going to go. But hang with me for a sec. So, this is 2003, right?
Yeah.
And it actually overlaps with like basically everybody's story, and it's kind of the New York story about how tech got big in New York. Of course, tech was going to be big here, but it got big by being connected to stuff that was already powerful. Like big adjacent industries, and you know, you're describing all this time with Balazs and the unbelievable place that New York is to live, and like how to access it, understand it, and then how to like turn other places into a place that might be that interesting. You know, whether it's like Nashville or Chicago or whatever, right?
Totally, and I think that you know, I got into this like the way a lot, like hospitality, like throwing parties in college, like the way that, you know, every college has their like, you know, people that throw the parties downtown or whatever. And I did that and as like a side hustle and a way to make cash in school, and was pretty good at it and really liked it. And, but honestly, frankly, I was like pretty lost. Like graduating college, if I wasn't going to do something in hospitality, I didn't, you know, it's funny now that I'm a venture capitalist, I never heard of venture capital. When I graduated from school, I still didn't know. I mean, the industry was different, but I also didn't. I didn't know what was happening in Silicon Valley. I didn't know that there was a tech startup scene.
I see. You weren't attuned to what's the new database? Like, what's the new, like, $100 million company?
I had no idea that businesses were being started and funded, and, you know, it was all very foreign to me. And my interaction with technology was, like, watching TV and owning mm-hmm. DVDs. And when I got back here, I got interested in media, and I think that's sort of another like osmosis living in New York thing. It's just like a very culturally relevant thing. And so while I was working for Andre, I got interested in media and started playing around with creating media on nights and weekends as a hobby while I was learning the business of hospitality.
Oh, so day job is the hotel business, and then you're like, let me make media. But what do you mean by media? Because like if we're talking about 2003, 2005, you're not on YouTube. There's no mobile anything.
Email newsletter.
Okay.
Email newsletter. Sending emails at first to my friends and an extended group of friends about stuff that I was doing out and about in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Restaurants and bars that I was going to, parties that I was going to.
Well, then what was like the very first email you sent?
The very first email was about a Mexican restaurant on 14th Street, the name of which I cannot remember right now, but I'm sure the Wayback Machine or something like that could find it. And it was, you know, it was just like sharing these little hidden secrets in a big city for young people.
Well, no, but let's stick with that first email. Yeah. So, like, at some point you sit down and you're like, all right, I think I'm going to just, like, send an email to my friends.
Daily
I'm
going
to, like, CC or BCC. Ah, Daily Candy.
Daily Candy. So, saw Daily Candy and said, this women in my life and girls that I'm friends with are reading this email and making social decisions about where to go and where to eat and what to
buy. And it feels super exclusive. Like, you get that email or you don't. Like, you can't just, like, search the web and get there. Yeah.
By the way, there was not even a web archive at that point. Mm. It was, like, you either received the email or it didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And so Daily Candy was having a big cultural moment, really on the rise, and had just gone.
That was a New York-based company. Yep. I think it was eventually controlled, not by IAC, but by one of the former, well, earlier, I believe it was one of the former AOL guys, right?
So Bob Pittman.
Right.
And the Pilot Group bought Daily Candy, bought a majority stake of Daily Candy from Danny, who had founded it. And I guess they ran it for several years and then did the like PE thing of flipping it to Comcast, and then Comcast did the big company thing of destroying it. You know, that old children's tale.
But at that moment, it was absolutely like super vibey, like,
oh boy,
much admired sensation.
They blew the doors off of whoever they covered. They would write about, you know, a new clothing store, and you would walk by the place the next day and there were 200 women waiting in line to get in. I mean, it was very influential and powerful, but it was also very clearly not for me. It was.
Yeah. Oh, right. Oh, yeah. Like the modern Manoverse was not.
It was just for, like, yeah. It was not a city guide for New York. It was a guide for New York women.
Yeah.
And I was sort of jealous that that existed.
Right.
And felt like I knew cool stuff going on. I was working for the coolest hotelier in the world, and I was on the inside of, like, cool
totally.
New York culture. And, like, by the way, it was a hobby anyway, and why not? And one of my best friends from college was a little technical and, you know, graduated with, like, a, you know, fine arts degree or something and had a good eye. And we said, hey, let's do this together. It'll be fun. We'll, you know. By the way, I'll tell you one other thing. Graduating from college and coming back, I lived by myself on Horatio Street in the West Village. It was lonely living by myself for the first time.
Like, what am I going to do tonight? I used to have a neighbor or like a dining hall or something.
Like, what do you do? And I'm somebody who needs Emily sitting here, like,
some energy.
Like, I need constant entertainment and interaction. Like, I'm not great by myself. And it was a way for me.
There are medicines for that now.
It was a way for me to, like always have something going on. And it was a hobby. I mean, it was a really, like, a labor of love in the early days. Mm. And it also kept me out. I'm like, well, I got to go out tonight because I got to go find
something new.
I got to go hunt.
And I can't go to the same old thing.
Yeah.
I got to let me go to Bushwick,
and
whatever. I heard
about
this.
Whatever it was.
Yeah.
And so it was fun, and it kept me out and meeting people and being social.
Yeah.
And
Did you take a little notebook with you and write shit down? Like, were you literally, like, journalistically scribing?
Yep. We took a little notebook and wrote shit down, and we actually have some very funny stories where there were nights where we would go to, like, you know, our 5th and 6th and 7th and 8th place, and you could, like, see the pen, like, at the last page, like, when one of us collapsed or, like, blacked out, like, run off the end of the page, and you're like, and we're spent.
Okay, so this seems like the best job in the world to have if you were paid for this job. But on the very first email, did you just open your email account? I guess it's even pre-Gmail at this point, and you just, like, put a bunch of people on CC?
By the way, you ask a brilliant question, which is, we made the whole email, and we had, like, collected a list of all of our friends.
And you couldn't fit them in the.
And we weren't allowed to send the email.
Yeah.
And so the first email was delayed by a week when we had to find an email service provider.
How can you do mass mailing?
And also, we had no money, so, like, we needed an email service provider that would, you know,
not charge you like $1,000, because, like, today you could do it for $10 a month or something, but
back
at the time
you could not.
You gotta, like,
deliverability
rent a server.
Was like a major thing back then.
Yeah.
I mean, a major thing, because without, like, the kind of spam filters that we have today, like, the way that it
everything got blocked.
Was
new accounts,
blockers. Yes. Yeah. So it was there were tech hurdles that like absolutely positively do not exist in any way today that were real.
Mm.
And we
to so, do something as simple as sending to 200 recipients.
And by the way, without
an image, all of
no
them,
images,
no. Yeah, all of
just
them, you know.
Words. I remember someone like probably 2 weeks in made the suggestion that we should consider using images.
And you're like, I have
and
no
I
idea
like,
how
get
to do that.
Out of here! I was like, that's a crazy idea. Images? I hadn't even thought of that. Like, and we had a lot of fun, and it was probably a month in when we wrote about a place, and then I don't remember if I called them to make a reservation or a friend of mine called or whatever it was, but it, we...
Wait,
it,
did you say, like, Thrillist when you wrote to them? Or
no,
called them or whatever?
No, but we couldn't get in.
Oh.
My friend couldn't get in, and I was like, this place just opened, what do you mean? And they're like, and then we inquired, and the person on the other line was like, this newsletter Thrillist just wrote about us, and we just got like 200 reservations.
You wrote about them before. Wait, first of all, you wrote about them before getting in, or you had gone there one time and you were trying to go again.
I think at that point we were writing about places that were like the
coming
opening
soon.
Day, opening
oh,
day,
right?
Like it wasn't a review. We were never reviewing places. We were making people aware of cool new stuff.
Okay,
and
okay.
So we suddenly were like, wait a second. Are we in?
Oh, your Daily Candy now.
What is going on?
We be Daily Candy now.
A little
yeah.
bit. Mm-hmm. And so we felt like we got a little swagger, and we realized that people were reading and taking it seriously. And
okay, but at that point then, so yeah. You're about a month in, you're just sending it to your friends. There's obviously no like subscribe link because it's like a plain text email you're hitting send on. The list is growing in the first days?
The list is growing in the first days, I don't remember how fast, but yes, we're getting people signing
like
up.
Someone replies.
I don't know how
something.
They were signing up. We may have had a form on a website.
Mm.
Adam was a, you know, amateur coder.
You could make a website.
I think
yeah.
he had built a form. I'm sure.
And you didn't publish the newsletter to the website at the time.
We didn't publish the newsletter to the website at the time, and we didn't even have the wherewithal to send every day. We like couldn't get it together, so I think it was like...
Well, that's actually what I was also wondering about. So if in that first month, I would have assumed as like a hobby, like let's see if it works, it'd be like once a week, maybe a couple times in
maybe
the month.
A couple times a week.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly. I think it was like Monday, Wednesday, Friday, something like that.
Well, that's actually a high pace to get going on, actually.
And we had a guy, we found very early on, I don't remember if it was for our first newsletter, but it may have been that Adam and I were not that good at writing, it turned out. And so...
Oh, really?
No.
How did you discover this feedback?
I think we just were self-aware enough to realize that we were clever, but like, we weren't writers in our soul.
Oh.
I think we felt like we were editors, maybe.
Sure. So you found someone who was good at writing, because actually that's another signature feature of Thrillist. I mean,
yes,
you know,
we really wanted a signature tone.
Distinctive voice.
Yes.
Yeah.
We used
to
do this silly exercise that where we would, you know, once the thing got going, there actually began like a little bit of competition for how to cover openings in New York. We had a few newsletters that were competing with us.
Oh.
Things like Time Out and some of the like older brands.
New York,
wanted to come and be.
Well, who were the other like upstart newsletter people? There probably would
have. Well, there was Daily Candy, who then became a competitor in a weird
And they
way.
Would have done some kind of like events going out.
They
section,
didn't want to
or,
like
yeah.
Daily Candy didn't want to write about the cool new restaurant that we wrote about the day before.
Okay.
And there was a newsletter called Urban Daddy.
Oh, Urban Daddy. That's like the most bro-ish of them, I think.
I don't know if it was bro-ish per
Maybe
se,
that's not the right term.
Like,
and by the way, we're using like 2025
yeah,
terms.
Yeah, I don't even know
yeah.
what you would call it, but like a definitively different tone
yeah.
than us.
Yeah.
Like a more self-important tone.
Okay. Like leather and whiskey.
Yes, like leather and whiskey.
Yeah.
I think that's a very good description. And then there was Flavor Pill.
Oh, Different. Flavor Pill. No, I like that one, too.
Yep.
That was a really good one. That was more like music,
more
EDM.
More music events.
Yeah.
I actually saw Sasha a few weeks ago, and he's doing great, which was really nice. It had been a long time. And there was also very different, but like Cool Hunting was in New York.
Oh, totally. Totally. And that was a... I had an email. That's true. And it was like products. It was like somebody invented some cool thing.
That was like predated Uncrate.
There's like a Danish company that made like a helmet you can fold and put in your back pocket.
You got it.
Yes.
And by the way, those guys remain like dear friends. Like there was this like little weird community. It was
newsletters.
Really fun.
And the age of newsletters.
The age of newsletters.
And these were all in New York?
These were all in New York.
Was there a rival somewhere else?
Well, the ones that succeeded in New York moved elsewhere.
Of course, of course, of course. And also the bloggers, like many of the great bloggers, right? Like Gothamist, let's say.
Totally.
Yeah. But, I mean, was there a newsletter like Superstar anywhere else? This is like, because, I mean, you describe it as like, I got interested in media. Today you would describe a newsletter as media. I think at that moment it was like, this dude is just like emailing his friends.
Until it got big. In year one we went from the 600 friends on day one to, in New York, we had 30,000 subscribers. But like 30,000 subscribers who are
super
guys
focused.
Living in New York City, opted in, going out all the time. Man, we were moving the market.
If like 1 or 2% of them are acting on it every week, it's to like change it.
Like changing businesses. It was really fun.
But was there another newsletter superpower, just to put yourself back in that moment? Because like, remember we were doing the whole like New York
energy
thing.
Yeah, the people that Daily Candy was the 800-pound gorilla. They were really the...
But not in New York, right? Because like, maybe we should own this. We should feel good about this. Maybe you and your compatriots kind of invented the newsletter, and every other schmuck in every other place was like, no, we just send transactional emails, click to buy, click to sell.
New York was the epicenter of newsletter culture back then.
Yeah, the idea of just like publishing through newsletters, basically. Yeah, yeah. And probably many of the great blogs, actually, right? Like,
it makes sense that New York would be the home to this stuff.
It would,
where, you know, so many great journalists live.
And then would you hang with like the blogger people as well as
the
newsletter people?
I think I was at Nick Denton's house 400 times. You know, and there was like the whole crew of everybody, and Jonah Peretti was running around.
Yes.
And that whole community. And Nerve.com.
Oh, yeah.
And The Onion, Sean Mills running The Onion, and Rufus running Nerve.
And would you
College Humor guys?
Oh, totally. Zach Klein. Yeah.
Josh and Ricky.
And then would you say that you guys like started converging your media formats? Because Thrillist ends up being also like a reload every day website.
Yeah.
And then some of the blogs all start doing newsletters, but they're never the same. Like Gothamist as a newsletter is just the summary.
I was gonna say, like the look, you start merging it, like in some way it's like the beginning of the end. And I mean that.
Oh, you are like diluting the purity, like
the
exclusivity, the ephemerality of the newsletter. Yeah.
Like the specialness of this product when you then are like, hold on, we have to now give web traffic because we need, you know, our comm score for the ad market, and we need ad impressions and whatever.
In order to make the website sustainable, we need some ads on
the
thing.
Yeah. Like, you know, you do, like, all these sacred principles get, you bend the rules for commerce, and eventually you, like, break the thing that was so special.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, Thrillist probably, when we had, you know, 400,000 subs across, like, New York, Chicago, LA, San Francisco, and Boston. I'm making that up.
Yeah.
But like that 400,000 core subs were like, we moved the market in those.
Mm-hmm.
We probably had less influence when we had 3 million subs and 20 million people on our website.
Spread across a billion like random places.
I think we were less influential with a much larger audience.
Yeah. Okay. So at some point you had to make money, right? So the thing's getting bigger, and then I guess people paid you to advertise in the newsletter?
Yep. People paid us to advertise. We started with local businesses.
Uh-huh.
I was going to local stores. I mean, it was like, and then I was trafficking the ads and you name it. Like,
and in the beginning, I guess you would just price it as like, oh, give me 20 grand and I'll put you in the next 5 newsletters or something.
I think that would be really cool if people would give me 20 grand to do that. It was more like, give me $500 and I'll put you in the next 5 newsletters. But, you know, and then and Daily Candy was the innovator of the business model. They created the dedicated email, which was...
Oh, like a sponsored email.
Daily Candy had this voice and this tone.
Oh, it's like,
aesthetic.
Hey, we were hanging out with this like designer and she had these cool shoes.
We will effectively write editorial about your brand in our voice.
Right.
We will not send out more than one of these emails a week.
Yeah.
And so it is 100% share of voice.
Right.
And it will be, and we will put apply our brand design. We'll make it with you.
And we'll be pretty choosy about it. I mean, it ends up being an important ad unit in like blog slash web,
and by the way,
advertorial,
and it performed like
sponsored content. Sponsored content,
yes, but that was the it performed like bottom funnel media,
like it just closed,
crushed, like you sold product.
Wow,
And we really were very inspired by Daily Candy. We created the same version of it. We call it an allied email, is what we called it at Thrillist. And it was the same thing, and we would go and, you know, bring a brand in and do the creative with them.
If Urban Daddy was like leather and whiskey, then what was the voice on Thrillist?
I think it wasn't like super frat, but it was much more like we watch sports.
Okay.
And we drink beer.
Yeah.
And we, you know, like.
Yeah. Like it's
but we're not like wrestling and chugging beer per se.
Yeah.
All of the time.
Right. So it's not as like snobby and exclusive, but it's not utterly everyday.
Look, it was always, I would say that one of my, I think that we never 100% landed the brand that existed in my brain.
Oh, okay.
Which is okay. But for a long time, it always remained sort of, you know, maybe for like a week, I felt like we'd capture it and then we'd lose it or something. We never fully.
Okay, well, what I'm gathering a little bit, it's like a sophisticated post-college, like New York emigre, like the kind of, it's.
But like not too sophisticated.
Not sophisticated.
You're 22 years old.
Yeah, right. Yeah, post-college. Right. Yeah, it's like, you're not at the Upper East Side wearing your white, like, Cox hat, you know.
Definitely not.
Right, yeah. Okay, well then, I mean, tell me the evolution of Thrillist a little bit. So then the business gets massive, you know, over the years.
The business got big, but, you know, I would say that we got really good at selling ads, and the ads performed. And you know, I started angel investing. And through angel investing, I started to get exposure to other media companies. Like, what a great advantage to start to see other businesses.
Oh, sure, yeah, because like all the like fledgling founders that either had a new newsletter or a blog or they had some new idea, you know, text message, whatever. You would have seen.
You got to see all the new things happening and the new technology, and you know, Jonah launched BuzzFeed and was always very tight with Jonah and got to watch the sort of evolution and you know, the growth there. My father launched the Huffington Post.
Oh yeah,
and I
right.
got to watch HuffPo grow, and I I just learned a lot about media and a lot about how to monetize media, and we got good at selling. And at selling advertising, and
then you added some brands.
We added a bunch, and then what happened was we built Thrillist up to, I don't know, maybe $30 or $40 million of revenue, which at the time was like
enormous.
Formidable.
Yeah, you're like pre IPO.
Like we were right. We were like making real money. Like it was it was a good business, and we had done it on a tiny amount of capital, maybe $1 million, $1.5 million, and we bought a commerce business called Jack Threads.
Oh yeah, we got to talk about that too, because like that's the other big thing that happens with newsletters is they become like actually transactional, like buy shit, right? Like Groupon.
And we were right at the front lines of that. I mean, it's really interesting to think back to, you know, like what we were in the middle of here, and we were in many ways like honestly one of the first movers in this idea of like content driving commerce. And you now look at things like, you know, the New York Times, like look at the New York Times business with games and with the Strategist and, or the Strategist is at New York Mag, but the.
Yeah, affiliate stuff for them, and then the games and subscription.
Wirecutter.
Yeah, also for affiliate stuff.
And like big businesses that we predated a little bit. We were there figuring out how you.
Yeah, and they thought you were like
the other.
They thought you were nothing, and you were inventing their current business model.
You know, they have the last laugh, I guess. But it was it was just a really interesting, fun time. We bought that business and scaled it so fast. But it was it was the same time that Gilt was ripping. It was basically a men's Gilt.
Oh, yeah.
So the same way that we built, we also did Thrillist Rewards, which was a Thrillist version of Groupon. Like, we were seeing, we saw Daily Candy, we saw Gilt, we saw Groupon.
Uh-huh.
We figured out a way to sort of do it in our voice and leverage our audience.
Uh-huh.
Jack Threads grew incredibly quickly and in the flash sales space. And by the way, went the way of the flash, the rest of the flash sales space, which is that the flash sale businesses went, they consigned a bunch of inventory, they sold it, it was, and then the business got big, and then you couldn't consign
great the supply side stopped supply. Offering it. Yeah.
Yes, and so then you started to buy inventory or make inventory, and then you looked like a regular retailer, and the regular retail business sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it was not, it was not asset light, and it was a very different kind of business and required a bunch of fulfillment and a bunch of other costs, let's just say. And so
So around this period, though, so, you know, you're talking a little bit about getting more involved in angel investing in other people's companies, and you're evolving the business and adding new, you know, sort of verticals and like commercial strategies. And then, you know, meanwhile, this whole category both of culturally linked startups and then also media linked startups is evolving. And I think New York's also kind of an HQ for all the e-commerce stuff. You mentioned Gilt. E-commerce, yeah, something like that. Like, you know, flash sales and all the other different ways of sort of buying and consuming fashion and other products. And you had something inside Thrillist. But yeah, maybe let's talk about some of the companies that are notable and interesting that you were either part of or that you sort of admired from that period. Because now we're at like 2008, 9, 10, right?
2008, 9, 10, correct.
Yeah.
In 2008, 9, 10 is when we had bought Jack Threads. We were scaling Jack Threads. I was really interested in commerce and interested in media. And that is, for me, what I think of as the real beginning of New York tech as of the 30-year history, the most recent 15 years is when I think New York tech really started to happen.
Oh, it totally got real. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I've spoken to a lot of different people, you know, late 90s. There's some interesting companies, some Wall Street kind of ones. Obviously, DoubleClick is legend. And then... yeah, early 2000s was tough, right? Like, there was 9/11, and there was like several years before things really started happening. Probably when you showed up in 2003 is the moment that people started wanting to do tech a little bit
more. But then
more.
You had the, you know, global financial crisis.
7/8 was also brutal, yeah.
So then it sort of, like, slowed down, and then it really started to pick up, and that's 10/11, when, that was when we decided to launch Lear Ventures at the time, before it was Lear Hippo. And Lear Ventures was really, you know, if we really go back to it, my father and I started it together. The idea was partially just a way for us to, like, get to do more together and spend time together.
Oh, that's sweet.
And he was building the Huffington Post, and I was building Thrillist, and there was a lot of similarities in that we were both building in media, but we were doing them totally independently of one another. We had made sort of together a few small angel investments in people in New York, and it felt like the market was sort of bubbling up. And a really funny story, which was Foursquare announced their Series A, and it was like, for the size of the company, the size of the round, it was like a big thing in New York. It really hit. And my dad called me and he said, "Oh man, you see this company Foursquare, this seems really cool." I know Dennis and Nadine, like, there's only 20 people that start companies in New York.
And he's like, "Why did you not mention this earlier?"
Yeah, he's like, "Why didn't you mention this?" I'm like, "I don't know." He's like, "Could we have invested in this?" I'm like, "Yeah, probably. Like, I know the guys. I'm sure we could have given them some money." He's like, "God, we should be investing in your friends. Your friends are doing such interesting stuff." And I'll make him sound maybe more articulate than he was at the time, but he basically said some version of all the friendships that you have could be recategorized as deal flow. You know everyone building cool things in New York, and we should invest in them. And by the way, I bet you some of my friends with some disposable income would want to invest in them. Do you think you could find cool deals and get us into cool deals? And I said yes, and he said, "You want to do something together for fun?" And I said, "Sure." And we went out and we raised $8.5 million. To go and invest in...
That's layer one.
Layer one.
What year was that?
2009, 2010. And that vintage, we ended up being in that first, like, you know, pre-seed round for Venmo, and the, you know, first round of BuzzFeed, first round of Business Insider, first round of Warby Parker. And by the way, like, that does, you know, you almost couldn't miss. There was, like, not that many companies, and a lot of them were actually pretty interesting, but we were in the middle of it. I mean, I was, like, really in the middle of the scene then.
Yeah.
And so those businesses got a little bit of momentum, and some got a lot of momentum, and we very quickly raised a $20-something million fund, and Ron Conway out in San Francisco had sort of taken an interest in New York a little bit. And,
oh, I don't remember that. That's actually a thing? Like, he sent Ron, someone over?
No, Ron himself, I think, realized that something was happening here and got and wanted to see more happening here. Like, huge credit to him, very early before anyone else on the West Coast was paying attention, he was. And said, hey, why don't I'll invest a little in your fund, and let me show you some cool stuff in San Francisco. I'll introduce you to some LPs. You invest a little in my fund, I'll invest a little in your fund. And Ron was such a helpful person in terms of sort of teaching us the early business of you know, pre-seed.
And were you doing it his style? You were doing what at the time would have been called seed, I guess. Today you might call it pre-seed. But you were doing, like, small checks early with 10 other names, and it was the first $1 million.
Everything collaborative, totally. And doing lots with him, and it did feel very much like we were.
And you decide fast. You meet them for half an hour, and you're like, okay, count us in.
Everything's just a party round.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And that was New York. That was New York. That just wasn't us.
Well, there were some, like, bigger names. I mean, like, I don't know if bigger name. Bigger check, larger.
RRE, there was SoftBank.
Oh, yeah, they actually had New York people at the time. Yep. Yeah,
Eric Hippo.
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, they had been here for decades. They had been here for decades, of course. Yeah.
Eric, and anyway, long story short is, you know, we kept going, and New York kept growing, and the strategy was, like, meet early, smart people and make bets on them, and it was that more collaborative party round
thing. Okay, well, then let's talk about the 2010s, and maybe a little bit less. I mean, yes, I want to talk about the evolution of the firm, but, like, things do change in the 2010s, and there are, I think, some
2013, 2014 was
powerful stories. Yeah, yeah. That's so let's talk about some of those powerful stories. How did you guys change your posture in that period? And then I also want to talk about, like, missed opportunities. There's things that New York should own that it does not own. So let's just start with some of the powerful stories of 13, 14, right? Yeah. Like, you know, SaaS is growing. Subscription-type companies are growing. There's starting to be, like, lots of billion-dollar companies. Like, you and me both know Cyrus from ZocDoc.
I'm
like,
an investor in his new business.
Yeah, well, as am I. And so that's the window, right? I mean, I think actually one of the first times that you and I actually shook hands was Business Insider, or it was Alley Insider at the time, Silicon Alley Insider, SAI 100.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It was at, like, the New York Stock Exchange, and there were just a few hundred people there. And
that's cool.
Yeah. And I think that they had just done a round with Kosla for ZocDoc, and you had just announced some great success.
So funny, right?
Yeah.
Very, very. It was an interesting time, and I think that, you know, for the first few years of my time investing, New York was still almost entirely consumer.
Yeah.
You had people from media and people doing things in the sort of commerce space. And it really was when Google and Facebook built larger offices here in 2012, 2013, 2014, that you saw this shift where sort of quote-unquote real engineering talent was flocking to New York.
Mm.
And that's when I think the more generalized New York tech market emerged, where you started to see people building enterprise software companies.
Databases.
Exactly. Just like a very different time.
Well,
I think was MongoDB before that, but, like, with
it had been started, but it ends up being, I think, one of the signatures of the 2010s, and then probably Datadog is sort of notable. It's like, no one would start that company in New York in 2005. You'd be a fool.
And that culturally, something had changed.
Yeah.
And that was exciting, and I think for us as a fund, that also represented, like, an opportunity for us to go from what we had been doing, which was these small party round checks, into mostly consumer businesses, into, hold on, if our job is to be around the best talent in New York, A, we should probably there's more to cover. We're going to grow the team. We're going to hire some young folks. We're going to think about sourcing. The fund's getting a little bigger. We need to think more about fund construction and ownership. We need to sort of build some muscles that we don't have.
Well, you're institutionalizing or sort of building the franchise of the firm during that period. And I guess you're also diversifying some of the verticals or themes that you invest in. You're sort of hunting for things where you can put $20 million or $50 million in potentially.
Well, not us, because we remain at the early stage. But businesses...
No, but your checks got bigger. I mean, they clearly got bigger from the $8.5 million first fund. Yeah. You started doing 2 and 5, probably, Series A's.
Not yet, no. And by the way, to date, we still don't do two Series A's.
Oh, really?
We're on our 9th fund. It's a $200 million fund.
What's the average check?
Pre-seed and seed. $1.5 million, $2 million.
Okay. Okay. So you still call it pre-seed and seed.
We very explicitly. Mm. That for us was, where everything changed. What never changed was this sort of very basic first principle of, we're really in the business of finding really early great talent and making bets on, with a huge amount of risk, on a person with sort of an unfair advantage in a space. And like, that's all we do.
Okay, so let's talk about how the people have changed, right? So in the early going, I guess they were your pals, but they had some qualities in common. They were sort of like weirdos working at the intersection of tech and media, creative, fashion, commerce.
Weirdos is a really important word.
Yeah.
And it's honestly, it's... New York could use some more weirdos. I think we're getting a few weirdos.
I thought now. New York's like the headquarters of weirdos. I mean, the new mayor is a weirdo.
Way fewer weirdos now than we did. New York was weird, really, really, really weird, and it was so fun and cool. And I will say, about a month ago, or maybe 2 months ago now, Borthwick, of course, introduced me to a company where he said, you know. Meet this company, and most of the time, I don't know, I'll meet for coffee, I'll meet for breakfast. People come here, and they said, no, you need to come to our office, we want to have you in. So I went to their office, and when I got there, they gave me a little cup of something, and they said, drink it. I said, I have a meeting after this, am I gonna? And I said, no, it's okay to drink it. And then I took my shoes off and I climbed on the floor up a flight of stairs in a tube covered in fuzz. Uh-huh. And I climbed out of it into some living room with like 8 or 10 people sitting around with talking to a fake dog on a screen, an AI pet. The company wasn't for us, but the experience was such a throwback in terms of like the soul of what I think New York tech sort of was, and what I was very happy to see still exists here, and something that I don't think can exist in San Francisco. And
TV, film, visual arts, fashion, I mean, true creative people. And I guess that's an ideal pitch meeting. I don't know what was in the drink. It probably didn't make you climb up. They told you to climb up.
I didn't have a choice. I wasn't getting into the pitch without the climb.
So it was like that then, and of course now it's more professionalized, so you'll meet some kind of ace database engineer who's like, I have a faster way to do a such and such, or a new foundation model, whatever. And it has broadened out a lot, I mean, like some of the other folks that I've been talking to in this process. I mean, and I guess like, venture and just startups are connecting more with some of the industries that we didn't really bump into in the early days, right? Like New York, I think one of the superpowers is there are a lot of big, large industries here. And as you spin things out of them, the first ones I think that were very productive were the media ones, right? I mean, like, that's the story you were just telling. A lot of other big industries, I mean, finance created some of the early wins. Actually, in the 90s, some of them were finance ones, things like trading and like, financial information. More recently, I guess there's stuff like pharma, healthcare is a huge industry.
Now. There's no limitation on what New York's going to produce. I mean, I guess there's some, belief right now that and it's to build a large language, one of the handful of generational large language models, you probably need to be in San Francisco. Just about anything else, you can go wherever you want.
Yeah, I mean, that belief, do you share that belief? I mean, it's probably too late to start a new competitor but the next great technology transition, I don't know, maybe could happen here. It didn't happen here. And so just talking about missed...
like maybe depending on crypto.
Missed
sort
swings.
Of crypto
about crypto. Let's talk about crypto. What a fuck up. I mean, shouldn't New York, world financial capital, be the headquarters of this technology that transforms the way that money works? I mean, it's not.
It's not, although it's not, it's also, like, not. Like, I do think that it is, New York is, has done fine in crypto.
Yeah, I would say meh. Like, that would have been one of the real gap closers to some of our competing venture ecosystems. I don't think that we had more big wins than SF. And certainly Asia has done amazing.
Yeah.
You know, like the Binances and all these
kinds of... But that's also just like regulatory...
Well, that's the answer, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that ought to... I mean, should that change? Or the other comment that other folks have made is that we have a lot of incumbent institutional power that has resisted that kind of reform here, and that's kind of slowed down the pace of innovation on that.
And, you know, we'll see now. I mean, I like literally cannot get into politics, but I would say that there is a... You know, this is a more interesting time for... crypto than it's been in
a Yeah, I mean, the present administration has a very different posture, and that may or may not help. Also, New York State matters and other things matter. But, I mean, if you just think about ecosystem development, that could have been a wonderful accelerant, and I don't think that it accelerated the pace of New York relative to other geographies. Like, you definitely wouldn't say that Boston, like, benefited massively from
crypto. No. I mean, you know, Boston's got, like, the biotech thing and, like, the connection.
And New York is becoming a very powerful market for health and biotech, for sure.
Well, health and, I mean, absolutely, of so many of the big, you know, health systems that are based here, and I think healthcare has been a really, like, a good story for New York.
Yeah.
And I also think New York has an interesting opportunity now with Europe and Israel and companies that are, as those markets, I mean, Israel's always been amazing, but as the European market, you know, catches up a little bit and those more and more ambitious companies come out of those markets and want to come to America, New York is the really obvious natural stop.
Yeah, gateway, time zone,
connection B, time zone, totally.
Yeah, I agree with that too. And actually, like in the Knotel business, that was always like a big driver of our growth. It's like,
Well, your boy Ron 20, Zori.
30, exactly, Ron Zori. Yeah, I mean, 20 or 30% probably of our customers were folks that were putting a touchdown here and getting rolling in New York, and they were Europeans a lot of the time. And that's absolutely true, actually. So New York benefits a lot from the prosperity of the European startup ecosystem, is kind of your point. Yeah, so like we gain every time, like London, Paris, Munich, Berlin. Yeah, I think that's true. So let's talk a little bit about AI stuff, just, you know, as this last passage. I mean, it's obviously the only thing that matters now. Nothing else matters. Everything else is stupid. The only thing that's going to drive anything is AI, right?
Of course. You can't even...
I mean,
like,
can you disagree? Yeah.
Of course.
So... what are our prospects? I guess we're not doing a foundation model. I guess we're doing apps. We're going to do like Rent the Runway AI or something?
No, I think we're going to do a lot. I think we're going to do infrastructure and then we're going to do apps. And there's a lot of surface area in those two things. And, you know, depending on who you talk to, someone would argue that like that's where the value is going to be created because the large language models are going to be raised to the bottom. And other people feel very differently, and you know, depending on what side of the bed I wake up on one day or the other,
they could both be pretty big, but it seems unlikely that the foundation models eat everything.
I think it's unlikely they.
And at this point, people don't even say foundation model. I mean, like OpenAI, Anthropic, they're not. I mean, they are platforms, services, you know, lots of verticals. There's a lot of end user applications. They have tons of like end user customers. They're not just
tons,
a foundation
no,
model.
Tons.
So one way of thinking would be like, oh yeah, those guys are like Google and they're going to eat all the the equivalent of whatever is ad revenue for this sequence. That'd be one way of thinking. And it probably is true, you know, that for all the media upstarts, Google ate the collective lunches. Because the media businesses in New York are a bit smaller. Yeah, and Facebook. Yeah, Facebook, Google. So that would be one way of thinking, is that the big platforms or, you know, foundation model people eat everything. I guess another way of thinking would be it could be somewhat more evenly divided. And then you described another way of thinking, which is, yeah, there's a billion of them, DeepSeek, whatever. You're not going to have any power as one of these models. And what will matter is, like, the very personalized, tailored, unique, verticalized application, something like that. At least flesh out that way of thinking. You don't have to say you believe it, but at least flesh it out a little bit.
Flesh out the way of thinking is that, you know, sort of cost of compute goes to zero. Every company has access to all of human intelligence from a competing group of 7 or 10 companies that all have to give it away, and they make money in other ways. And there's a whole slew of applications that get built, I think, in particular, sort of service as software businesses that were service businesses that can now be run by, you know, let's just use the term agent as for lack of a better one today, that brings huge amounts of efficiency or scale to different industries. And like, there's going to be a bunch of new vertical players that create a bunch of value, and they'll be, and then you look at categories that are big consumer categories, music or dating or you name it, that there's going to be a new paradigm in terms of like every category is back in play in some way, where conceivably the company that figures out how to use this technology in the most novel, interesting ways, both from sort of a data perspective and an interface perspective, will create great value, and maybe you get to unseat some companies that seem like they can't be unseated.
Oh, certainly, just replace Web 2.0. I mean, replace the existing internet with agents.
With a new agent. With
agent,
a new, right.
Agent is app, agent for everything.
And that's something, an app. And so, you know, I look, thank God I'm not a Series A, B, C investor, because I do think that it's really hard right now to make those big capital bets and figure out what the future holds. We, as you know, we get back, we still just do this first principle people thing, and you know, my job is how do you find people who are really, really, really smart and are hopefully going to be on the right side of history and figure this stuff out and do the things that I don't know how to do.
And where else will you find weirdos? Where else will you find weirdos? If you had to pick a city to find weirdos, you tell me.
I mean, there's a lot of different kinds of weirdos. I think New York weirdos are a specific, wonderful flavor. But I look, I think that, you know, I think there's like interesting pockets of tech in Toronto and in Austin and in, you know.
But on January 30th, we're going to celebrate some New York weirdos, right?
On January 30th, we're going to, I like.
Thank you for being on.
Let's go.
Thank you for being on.
Okay. This was fun, dude. I really enjoyed this.
It was a pleasure.
How many people are you interviewing?